I wanted to tell you a story I heard several years ago. It was a story of a former church member who was driving home very late one night from work. He worked in a different place. He lived out in the country, and he worked in a fairly nearby city, maybe an hour and a quarter away. And he was coming home late from work because he had stopped at the bar. He's a former church member, I should say. He had consumed quite a bit of beer and was under the influence, frankly. The road he was driving on was about 1.5 lanes wide, and it was a gravel road through a very dark forest. Now, nothing but a deep national forest for a few miles, just a gravel road. And his headlights were on, and that's about all the company he had, except for the moon. The moon was out, and that night it was a brilliant red moon. In fact, what's referred to as a blood moon. It was so red, and remember his state where he was. This former church member had heard many sermons over the years, and while he no longer attended church, those sermons on prophecy stuck in his mind, and he was scared. He remembered the reference to the blood moon in Revelation 6 and its significance at the very end time. He thought that that was it. He thought that everything was ending, because that's what stuck out, is toward the end there would be the sun would be dark and the moon would be as blood. Again, he was under the influence of alcohol, and he was terrified that he had lost touch. Prophecy sticks in our mind. Now, growing up in the church, I remember those messages too, and some were scary. I have a memory that's really clear for me when we were nearing home after a long journey to church and back. We had moved, when I was about 4 years old, we moved out of the mountains down into the central part of the state, the flatland, as you might call it. And I was about 6 years old probably at this time. We were coming back from church. I remember, in my mind at least, where we were. And I was terrified that day. And I remember that because I think we'd had a sermon, and somehow I believed that there were going to be soldiers hiding in the closet. And that memory for me is very clear. If indeed that was what was said, sometimes our memory can play tricks on us. I think whoever was speaking was extrapolating and embellishing at best. Now, we don't have to embellish scripture to get to the points we're supposed to understand about prophecy. There's no need to embellish. Now, the fact is that we did have many sermons and sermonettes on prophecy years ago, and sometimes, as nearly all of us tend to do, we wanted to predict dates, especially about the end times and the return of Jesus Christ to establish the kingdom of God. And the one thing that happens with predicting dates is that we were wrong. Recently, I, as probably you have too, have felt that the events in this country and the world seem to be escalating downward at a more rapid rate than in the past. I would venture to say that in the last 10 years, at least in this country and around the world too, we have seen a marked deterioration in morality. There are many things to point to. I'm not going to point to them, all of them, but you know what those things are. You could probably, if you think about it, you could probably list 10 things really quickly of the different points of morality that have really declined in the last 10 years. I think one of the most recent, and I will mention this, one of the most recent is the passing or the introduction of legislation about late-term abortion. Now, late-term abortion, some in the different media online, traditional and non-traditional media, have claimed that terms such as post-birth termination have actually been stated. Post-birth termination. So a lot of people have been claiming, look, you're advocating for infanticide. I think we all know what that is. There are conflicting reports about that claim, about what was actually said, but it has truly shocked many in this country. Now, New York State has experienced this recently, as has the state of Virginia. Now, Virginia is known, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, Virginia is known as the Old Dominion. In fact, there's a university in Norfolk called Old Dominion University. That Old Dominion, why is it called Old Dominion? It's referencing when the Dominion, it was called that because it was the Dominion of the King of England. It's really the starting place for the English settlement in this country. The first successful English-speaking settlement of Jamestown was in Virginia, and that has significance to me personally, that state was actually even considering it. It made it to vote, or at least it was introduced, that legislation, and of course the governor of that state has been under a lot of pressure to resign because he was, and many believe he was advocating for that legislation. Now, morality is one area of decline. The violence we see today can literally be described as shocking. The things that we see and the evil and the corruption we experience is growing rapidly too. That leads us to wonder, it leads me to wonder, are we living in the end times? How can we know? How can we know if we're living in the end times? What are some of the signs? Now, it's been said that as much as one-third of the Bible is about prophecy, and nearly 90% of that has yet to be fulfilled. Most of the Bible itself centers around physical Israel, not just what is known as the state of Israel today, but physical Israel as described in the Bible, and also spiritual Israel. Now, what I mean by spiritual Israel, I think we know it's called the Israel of God as described in Galatians 6. We won't turn there. But prophecy is broader than just Israel. Prophecy refers, in many instances here, to the entire world, not just Israel. What will happen as the end of this age approaches? Let's go to 2 Timothy 3. We'll read some scriptures you might be familiar with, but in the context of, are we living in the end times? 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 to 5. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 to 5. The heading in my Bible says, Perilous Times and Perilous Men. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, and notice that the term last days, there are and there will be last days. Know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves. We've read this many times, haven't we? Lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, which I think we can point to examples of that today, but denying its power, and from such people turn away. There will be such a thing as the last days. This world won't go on as it is. There is a plan. But are the events today any worse than they were 70, 75, 100 years ago? Are they worse than they were 1,500 years ago? How will we know if we're in the end time? God has provided prophecies in His Word to let us know what to expect and what to do. Why do we have prophecy? Why do we have it? There's a third of the Bible that's prophecy. Why is that? What is the purpose of prophecy? You know, we know the verse, and you probably know this verse, and many of you can probably turn to it where it is, but to paraphrase, it says, without vision, the people perish. Without vision, the people perish. Let's turn to Proverbs 29. Now, some versions of the Bible will translate that slightly differently. Still the same meaning, but it's a little different. The English Standard Version says it this way, Proverbs 29, verse 18. Again, this is a familiar verse, and it says, without vision, the people perish. Some translations, some versions of the Bible say it slightly differently. The English Standard Version says this, where there is no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint, or perish, as some versions say, but blessed is he who keeps the law. Prophecy or where there's no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint. There's a vision there. What is that vision? What does it give us? What does prophecy give us? It's about the future. The prophecy's almost always about the future. There are examples in the Bible of fulfilled prophecy, and we won't turn to many of those today, but there are examples of that. But prophecy gives us, why is it there? Well, it gives us knowledge. It gives us inspiration. It gives us encouragement. It points us to Christ. And perhaps just as importantly, it gives us hope. It gives us hope that God has a plan in place to establish his way of living, his government, his kingdom. And hope is important. I love the topic of hope. I know I've spoken about it before a few times. I try not to talk about it all the time because I think hope and trust, those things are really short words that have big meanings. But what is hope? Why is that? Let's go to, well, we won't turn there, but I'll reference it. Hebrews 6:19, we won't turn there. We're told that hope is the anchor of the soul. Hope is the anchor of the soul. That's important. I like a quote from Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King. Now, this is a, you'll hear at the end of this quote something really famous, but we often don't hear this first part of it. The first part is about hope. I love this quote. He said, "If you lose hope, somehow you lose the vitality that keeps life moving. You lose that courage to be, that quality that helps you go on in spite of it all. And so today, I have a dream." We know that part, right? But I think the part before is beautiful. If you lose hope, somehow you lose the vitality that keeps life moving. You lose that courage to be, that quality that helps you go on in spite of it all. And so today, I have a dream. He's talking about hope. Prophecy helps us and we need it, but not just in any prophecy. So prophecy gives us the inspiration. It tells us what's coming, but we need it. But what kind of prophecy? Let's turn to 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3, verses 1 to 7. What kind of prophecy? Because there's a lot out there, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But what prophecy? Not just any prophecy here. 2 Peter 3, verse 1, it says, "Beloved, I now write to you the second epistle, in both of which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust, and saying, 'Where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willfully forget, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water.'" This earth is not here by accident. "By which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." Verse 2 is what I want to focus on, though. What prophecy should we look to? Verse 2, "Be mindful of the words written," or which were spoken before, "by the holy prophets." Well, why not other people? Why not believe anybody out there? I mean, what about the people, the others we hear today? Are we to believe someone who has a YouTube channel? Because a lot of people do. This is a really hot topic. There are millions of people who are interested in prophecy. Are we supposed to believe them because they have a YouTube channel or a blog or a radio or a TV show? Just because they have ideas? There's a blogger, I won't say her name, who believes the United States is Babylon. She believes in the significance of the blood moons now. She makes lots of predictions, you name it. Now, most of you know our daughter Olivia, who all the energy she has today, she had as a baby, except it was trapped in a small body. And she didn't sleep very much. And we would trade off, like, you know, getting up early with her. And she would get up really early. So on Sunday mornings, I might have told this story before, on early Sunday mornings, I knew all the Sunday morning preachers. Because I would listen. Well, there wasn't anything else on, right? So there was one, you know, that there's a like a phrase that one of them had. It's like, I still have it in my mind. It was about evidence. Is there enough evidence in your life? But there was another one. It was a man, it was a husband and wife team. And while Olivia's crawling around or trying to, you know, I'm trying to keep her busy, I'm trying to distract myself just with some noise. And it's a husband and wife team with a show about nothing but prophecy. And I think it went on, it was at least half an hour and maybe an hour every week. I think it's still on. And they were getting funding for this show, and they had national coverage. That's not cheap, even early Sunday mornings. But it was all about prophecy, all about prophecy. You know, many years ago, living in Pasadena, we had several versions of Elijah show up. We had several versions of the two witnesses. People are interested in prophecy. There are dozens of books written every year on prophecy. I say dozens, it's probably scores and scores of books. And they sell, people buy them. And most are about the end times and the return of Jesus Christ. And many have something in common. Guess what they want to know? They want to know when Christ will return. That's almost always what they want to know. But do we believe those people? Or as in 1 Peter, who do we believe? God tells us to believe him. He tells us to believe him through the prophetic writings he has provided to us through the holy prophets. We are to believe him. That is a point we will see more about shortly. Now, Jesus Christ actually gave an outline of prophecy on two occasions. He gave one while he was alive on earth on the Mount of Olives, the Olivet prophecy, Matthew 24, and it's also in Luke 21. So that was one outline. And the second outline was after he was resurrected and he descended to sit on the right hand of his Father. And he gave that outline of prophecy through an angel to the Apostle Paul. And that's outlined in Revelation 6. So if you think of the books that are central to prophecy, it's usually Matthew 24. It's a few chapters in Daniel and a few chapters in Revelation. Now, there are other prophecies as well. The book of Obadiah is a prophecy about Edom, or as we believe it to be modern-day Turkey. There is a prophecy in Psalm 83, we might turn there later if we have time, that talks about how the descendants of Ishmael, the Arabs, as well as the Moabites and Ammonites, some of them, the Amalekites, they will gather together against Israel. I think we've seen that. So there are lots of prophecies out there. But one of the core chapters is in Matthew 24. Let's go there. And with a question in mind, are we in the end times? Matthew 24, verse 3. We'll read a few highlight verses here. Matthew 24, verse 3. And guess what the disciples asked? What question did they ask? It's the question that people ask today. It's the same question. Guess what it was? What is the question most asked about today? Verse 3, Matthew 24, it tells us. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, guess what? Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? When will it be? But they had a little different question to it, a different angle. They said, and what will be the sign of your coming? So that is something we want to look at and we can see. And Christ tells us many things here. Verse 4. What is the first thing that Christ said? It's really important. It was the first thing he said. So that was, in many ways, the most important. Verse 4. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. And that's a lesson to us. Take heed that no one deceives you. Now, a lot of that can go away if we don't, and again, I don't think anyone here is. I don't know of anyone that is. But if we don't listen to the people who have the blogs and the YouTube channels, if we look to the Word of God. So, take heed that no one deceives you, verse 5, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. Don't be scared. We have to trust in God, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. Verse 9, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. That had fulfillment at that time, and it will have fulfillment in this time, and we won't turn to Revelation 12, but Revelation 12 provides more detail as well, indicating that many of the saints will be protected as well. Verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Now, we've read that many times, and it could mean, and there are different, slightly different ways of interpreting that and reading that, but we read it and we think, at least I do, it's like, oh yeah, the love of many will wax cold. Why would that be? Why? If we can project a little bit into the future, we can likely see how this might happen. The stress of the time could easily wear someone down. Just the trial, the tribulation, the times. It could be to the point that people are just hanging on. There's so much coming at you. The mental anguish resulting from that could easily cause the love of many to wax cold. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Now, there was an early fulfillment of this in the first century, but there will be a latter time. And that's one of the, as we know, one of the principles of prophecy. Often there's a dual fulfillment, an early fulfillment, and a latter fulfillment, and there will be one of this one as well. Verse 21, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. It's the worst ever situation. The worst ever. And I don't want to scare people. I was telling Mr. Black, I was a little concerned that the Action City event was canceled. I knew a lot of the younger people would be at that. And I don't want to scare people, but I don't think we have to be. I mean, it will be a terrifying time, but God will take care of us. He will. These things must come to pass, as it says here. But it will be the worst ever situation. It says here, there will be great tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the world. It's the worst ever. And do you think of the Jewish people that went through the tremendous atrocities in the late 1930s and the early 1940s? And it will be worse than that. It will be worse than the wars that we've had throughout the 20th century, where literally millions and millions of people were killed. Verse 24, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. So another warning, don't be deceived. See, I have told you beforehand, don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. Verse 27, for as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. So he's answering the disciples there, and it's an answer for us too. You'll know when I'm coming. You'll know. You'll know when I'm coming. Don't worry. It will be clear. It will be clear. Verse 32, this is the parable of the fig tree. Verse 32, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near and it's at the doors. It's at the doors. It is a terrifying thing to think about. It is. But it is in the Bible. It is something we need to think about and from time to time. And we have to trust God. We have to trust God. And what about the answer to the most asked question? What's the answer to that? And should we spend time on that? Verse 36. We'll start in verse 34. But assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. in verse 36, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So don't worry about it. It's not what to worry about. There's a different set of actions we're told to take. Don't worry about it. Of course, this is the most asked question, and we're simply told that only God the Father knows. So don't spend time worrying about it or following others today who say they know when it is. They don't know, because the Bible says they don't know. And stocking up on lots of food, again, everybody can do what they want to do. Everyone's a free moral agent. But when someone tells you to do that, and they're all at the same time not preaching the gospel, they're not adhering to God's law, they are not preaching the truth, and they don't know the day, because it says here that only God the Father knows. Only God the Father knows. So what else are we told to do? And here in verse 42 and 44, we'll see. 42, really clear. If we're not to worry about when he's coming, what are we supposed to do? Verse 42, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. We're told to watch. We're told to watch. In verse 44, therefore you also be ready. Watch and be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Coming at an hour you do not expect. There was a minister many years ago who said it, I have to make sure I get it exactly right. He said it something like this: the return of Christ will come later than we think, but sooner than we expect. Later than we think, but sooner than we expect. Which seems to contradict it, right? But in many ways, it's, and again, I think I might have told this story before, but again, it's about one of our daughters. We were expecting Olivia on August 26th, and it looked like she was going to be born earlier. In fact, it looked like she was going to be born 3 or 4 weeks early. And August 26th came, and so we thought it was going to be earlier, right? So we're planning, we're thinking, oh, it's going to be the end of July, and then it's August 15th, and then it's August 26th. So it was later than we thought, and then all of a sudden, Sarah went in for a doctor's appointment. I was with her, and he said, you need to go directly. His office was near the hospital in the same complex. He said, you're going to be checked in now. Guess what? We weren't ready. It was later than we thought, but it was sooner than we expected, even though it was past the due date. And I was like, you know what? I got to go home. I got to, they're going to wheel Sarah to the room. I'll go home and get the suitcase that we hadn't packed. It was later than we thought, but sooner than we expected. And then she came out, and what a piece of work she was. Be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. We don't expect it. People have been waiting for it for hundreds of years, and it's going to be when we don't expect it. But we have the signs. We're simply told not to be deceived, and watch and be ready. Don't be deceived. Watch and be ready. That's it. Now, of course, that is a lot. But the instruction is simple. We should study prophecy. We certainly should. We should watch what's happening, but don't get depressed about it. Sometimes we watch too much. I don't think we have to check the news site 50 times a day. I think that's again, a matter of an opinion, as a matter of opinion, rather. But we should study prophecy. We should know what's happening, but not be deceived and be ready. And we'll see a little bit about that, a little more about that shortly. Now, with so much of the Bible being about prophecy, there's a lot to cover. I've already referred to Psalm 83, which is an interesting prophecy. I've referenced Revelation 6. I don't plan to turn there. Revelation 12, we could turn there. There's so many things. The book of Obadiah. I mean, there are so many things we could turn to. And that's just a few. We haven't even mentioned Daniel 7. There's so many things. What do we focus on? What really has to happen before Christ will return? There are several of those things as well, but there are three things I want to focus on in the rest of the message today. I'll cover three things that must occur before Christ's return. Three things that must occur before Christ's return. Number one, I'll entitle it here, the King of the South. The King of the South. Now, in the Mediterranean area, an influential person will rule a united Arab state under one banner, and this area is generally south of Jerusalem. There will be a King of the South. And we can see that right now the Arab states are pretty disparate. There are two general camps, but they are mobilizing. There is a lot of effort to that. And again, Psalm 83 is an interesting prophecy about that. Now, in the ancient times, we've talked about the Assyrian Empire here before. There was the Assyrian Empire, and that was the empire that brought down the northern 10 tribes, and several years later, they tried to take down the house of Judah, but they failed in the time of King Hezekiah. And after that was followed by the Babylonian Empire, and that is the empire that did, in fact, take Judah captive. And then after that was the Persian Empire with Cyrus. And the prophet, there is a prophecy in Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 45, and again, there are a lot of prophecies in Isaiah as well as Jeremiah. But Isaiah 45, I believe, I don't have that with me, is a prophecy of Cyrus before he was born. In fact, many years before he was born, right? But Cyrus was this leader, kind of that came out of from nowhere and led this Persian Empire. And they were quite different. You know, the Assyrians were vindictive and cruel people, and the Babylonians weren't far behind. They were very similar people. But the Persians were different. The Persians, when they would take people captive, they wouldn't say, you know, they wouldn't move them out of the area like the Assyrians did. They wouldn't move all those people to a different part of their empire. They would let the people stay where they were, and they'll say, look, as long as you behave yourself and you pay tribute, you can keep living as you are. Cyrus was a different leader that way. But eventually, Cyrus died. And then what empire came after that? Well, the Greek Empire. So it was the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, and then the Greek Empire. And it was led most notably by a young leader named Alexander the Great. I'm sure we've all heard of Alexander the Great, and most of us know that he was a young leader. In fact, he died at age 33 in 323 BC. Now, interestingly enough, there was a story probably almost actually a month or so ago that Alexander the Great died and people couldn't quite figure out why he died. Was it liver poisoning? Was it alcohol poisoning? Did somebody actually poison him as well? They couldn't figure it out. There's a new theory of how Alexander the Great died, actually. And it seems fairly plausible, but there are many theories. The new theory is put forth by a professor out of a university in New Zealand, and she believes that he died of Guillain-Barre disease. Now, the interesting thing about Alexander the Great, apparently, when he died, his body didn't show decomposition for at least 6 days. And so a lot of people thought, well, this guy was a god. He was a god. He was certainly one of the most brilliant military leaders anybody had ever seen. He was brilliant. But Guillain-Barre disease, what she's putting forth is that it actually was an autoimmune disorder that was pretty significant. And the reason his body didn't start showing signs of decomposition is he actually wasn't dead for quite a while. But the breathing was so light, it was invisible. So it's just an interesting aside. But after the after his death, his empire split into three pieces, into three different kingdoms. And we'll turn to, let's go and turn to Daniel 11. We'll read about that. We'll read about that in prophecy as well. Daniel 11 and verses 3 to 4. It's fascinating, right? If a lot of people have interest in history, and you can see how it kind of ties in with early fulfillments, but also latter day fulfillments, is very interesting for people. Daniel 11, verse 3 to 4. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. When he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided to the four winds of heaven. But not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. So his kingdom didn't go to his son. It actually went to three different leaders of his army. Now, historically, this king of the south was the dynastic leader of the Ptolemies. That was one of those three kings. Or it was the Egyptian branch of the Greek Empire. It was to the south. The king of the south battled it out for over a century as the Egypt-based Ptolemies struggled for supremacy against the Syrian-based Seleucids, another branch of the Greek Empire. Now, this was one of my most favorite classes in college. It was the history of Western civilization and studying these different kings that took over from Alexander the Great. Now, interesting here is this same prophecy that we read about here that's clearly referring to Alexander the Great, and we believe that. This same prophecy suddenly takes a huge leap into the time of the end. So we can see, again, a principle of an early fulfillment and a latter day fulfillment, and that's what we're seeing here. And it takes a big leap when we find a latter day king of the south provoking and fighting against the king of the north, which we'll read about in a moment. Let's stay in Daniel 11, and we'll go down to verse 40. Again, we're talking about the king of the south. This person leading a united Arab organization has to come to power in the end times. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. This is the end time. This is a fulfillment later on in this prophecy in Daniel 11. This united Arab organization will attack the king of the north, who we'll talk about in a minute, and experience a devastating defeat. This leads to the second element that falls into place. And again, you can see this Arab power is very much alive today. And this country was shaken to its bones on September 11th, 2001. We all remember that. Most of us do anyway. But that will come, that state will come, and that king of the south will be a powerful leader leading this united Arab group. The second thing that must come to pass before the return of Christ is the king of the north, already referred to here. Daniel's prophecy tells us that once this end time king of the south has provoked the king of the north, that the latter will swoop down on him with massive military force and invade and conquer much of the Middle East. That's again in Daniel 11. Let's go to verse 41. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape his hand. This is talking about the king of the north has come down south of Jerusalem into the seat of this Arab power. But this king of the north shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Many believe that Edom is Turkey, and Moab and Ammon are the modern-day descendants of Lot, and it's in some ways the Jordanian people and others. Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now, elsewhere in Bible prophecy, the king of the north is referred to as the beast, and we won't get into that in great detail today. It's the name assigned him by the Apostle John in the book of Revelation. If you want a reference to that, that's Revelation 13, verses 1 to 10, and also Revelation chapter 17, verses 3 to 17. So Revelation 13, 1 to 10, and chapter 17, 3 to 17. Now, this struggle between the king of the north and the king of the south will happen before Christ's return. That will be a sign of the end times. Now, the third sign, the third thing that must come to place, must come to happen and to take place before the return of Christ will be the battle for Jerusalem. the battle for Jerusalem. Let's go to Ezekiel 5. Ezekiel 5. And we hear about Jerusalem all the time. I haven't been to Jerusalem. I have had the opportunity to travel some outside the states, but not, and I've been to Jordan, but I haven't been to Jerusalem. I know many of you have. I do want to go to Jerusalem, but we see it in the news all the time. We know that it is now the center of attention. It's the center of the action, even now, and it has been for some time, and it will become even more so. So watching what happens in Jerusalem, not just all of the Middle East, but Jerusalem in particular, there will be a battle for Jerusalem. Ezekiel 5, just one verse here. Thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the midst of the nations and the countries all around her. Right in the middle of the action is Jerusalem. Now it's very clear that Jerusalem will continue to be the center of action, or of the action. That is even the case today. And one of the reasons is that it's set in the midst of the area richest with the resource that moves the world economy. What moves the world economy? Now, there's an interesting business here in the Twin Cities. It's called NatureWorks. I don't know much about it, but it's an interesting business because it's actually a spinoff of a large agricultural company, and they make the like a replacement for a PVC pipe. And the reason they make it from organic materials that are grown, right? And that's a big deal. Why? And it's because we are so reliant on everything petroleum-based. PVC pipe, plastics are made from petroleum-based. And that's what moves our economy. That's why there's so much interest in the Middle East. And that's a big reason that Jerusalem is a center of attention for the world. We know that. But it's also the center for three of the largest religions of the world, the monotheistic religions of, as we know, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. It is and will be the hotbed of growing tension for world events and end time events. We have to watch Jerusalem. And it will also be, and most importantly, it will be the center of the kingdom of God. Let's go to Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14, verses 2 to 4. Zechariah 14, verses 2 to 4. Again, about the battle for Jerusalem. For I will gather the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, and he fights as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, and half of it toward the south. All nations will gather to battle against Jerusalem. It's a really pivotal part of prophecy. These things will happen before Christ returns. And Christ's feet will stand on the Mount of Olives facing Jerusalem. Let's go to Luke 21. Read two quick verses there before we conclude. Luke 21, verses 20 to 24. Luke 21, verses 20 and 24. In verse 20, it says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Watch Jerusalem. Watch the battle for Jerusalem. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. This is something we can watch for. Verse 24, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So when we see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that the desolation is near, and the end times of the Gentiles has to fall into place. So what are we supposed to do now? I mean, again, if a third of the Bible is prophecy, we haven't even touched on, a sliver of it, really, but it's important. Those things are important. But what are we supposed to do now? Prophecy is provided to us for a vision. It gives us hope. I think that's a beautiful thing. And again, just the way it's said in Hebrews 6:19, hope is the anchor of the soul. It's a beautiful way to think about it. Prophecy gives us that. We know a better time is coming. Prophecy is given to us for inspiration. It's encouraging us to keep going. There's a lot of good that comes from prophecy. Now, we read Matthew 24 earlier, and we think about Christ's ministry kind of in Matthew, kind of sets it up pretty nicely, right? Matthew 5, 6, and 7 really talks about, you know, the new covenant and what it really means to be like God. And then toward the end, it's Matthew 24, and it talks about the end time. But the chapter that follows 24, Matthew 24, is a companion. In fact, it probably shouldn't have a break between there. Matthew 25 is a companion to Matthew 24, I believe, and they belong together, and it gives us instruction about what we should be doing now that we know these things that are talked about in Matthew 24. It flows on very naturally. So Matthew 24 gives us signs of the end times. Let's turn to Matthew 25. But Matthew 24 told us three things, right? It says, don't be deceived. It told us to watch, and it told us to be ready. It told us not to be deceived. We need to watch and to be ready. But Matthew 24, the first two-thirds of the book, essentially, are two parables we're really familiar with, but maybe sometimes we don't notice that they trail right after Matthew 24 for a reason. Number one is the parable of the 10 virgins. We won't read the whole thing. In fact, the first 12 verses kind of lay out the story of the 10 virgins. We know that story, so I won't read it. But it provides, as most parables do, a parable provides a core lesson. And the lesson of the parable of the 10 virgins is what? Is to be ready. So be ready. Verses 1 to 13, it's about being ready. Verse 13, it says, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. We don't know. One question that people are most interested in is that, we don't know. It's clearly said here, verse 13, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. But be ready. Be ready for that. The second lesson is in verses 14 to 30. And again, we won't read the whole thing. But the parable of the talents, we know that. What does it teach us? What's the one core lesson that the parable of the talents teaches us? That we have to be growing. We have to be growing. I find it difficult. Do you? We all have things that, you know, that we're kind of a walking assembly of the blood coursing through our veins is a lot of personality traits we've inherited through our ancestors. And those things are hard to get rid of, but we should be growing. We're supposed to be growing. The parable of talents teaches us that, and that we have to be yielding to God's creation of his character within us. We have to be practicing righteousness. And verse 29, it says this, for to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance from him who does not have. Even what he has will be taken away. Cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We're supposed to be growing. And it's not just, we have to have effort, but we have to yield to God's creation in us. And then verses 34 to 40 is the third lesson. And the lesson there, I will read a few verses here. Verse 35. Verse 35. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Verse 37. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you and thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in or naked and clothe you? When did that happen? Or when did we see you sick or in prison? We don't remember that. And when did we come to you when you were in that state? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to the least of one of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So we're told that we are to be ready. We are to always be growing, and we're to serve others. We're to serve others and let God's love in us through His Spirit flow through us to others. That's hard too. But it's the love of God in us, not just our effort. So we're told we're to be expressing God's love by serving others every day, being filled with God's Spirit of love that is about action. Somebody told me many years ago that love is a verb. Love is a verb. It's action. It's based on action. Now, these are interesting times. These are scary times. Are they the end times? We know what those signs will be. We're encroaching on those end times. We see things falling into place. We see many of the events in this country and the world forming and moving toward the end times. Prophecy provides so much for us, and there's so much to study and learn so that we can be who we need to be. So we need to be, again, to summarize, not to be deceived by false prophets. We need to watch. We need to be ready. We need to be growing, and we need to serve others. Are we living in the end times?